and pick off her queen rook in exchange for it. It was 7 moves away, and she hadn't seen it. She leaned her elbows on the table and rested her cheeks against clenched fists. She had to work this out. She put Lutsenko and the crowded auditorium and the ticking of her clock and everything else out of her mind and studied, going through dozens of continuations carefully. But there was nothing. The best she could do was give up the exchange and get his rook pawn as consolation. And he would still have his queenside attack going. She hated it. But it had to be done. She should have seen it coming. She pushed up her queen rook pawn as she had to, and watched the moves play themselves out. 7 moves later, he got the rook for his bishop, and her stomach knotted when she saw him take up the piece in his hand and set it down at the side of the board. When she took the rook pawn 2 moves later, it was no real help. She was behind in the game, and her whole body was tense. Just stopping the advance of his pawns down the queenside was grim work. She had to return the pawn she had taken from him to manage it, and, that done, he was doubling his rooks on the king file. He wouldn't let up. She made a threat toward his king as a cover, and managed to trade off one of his rooks for her remaining one. It did no good to trade when you were down, because it increased his advantage. But she had to do it. Lutsenko gave up the traded piece, casually, and she looked at his snow-white hair as he took hers in exchange, hating him for it. Hating him for his theatrical hair, and hating him for being ahead of her by the exchange. If they went on trading, she would be ground down to nothing. She had to find a way to stop him. The middle game was Byzantine. They were both entrenched with every piece supported at least once, and many of them twice. She fought to avoid trades and to find a wedge that could bring her back to even. He countered everything she attempted, moving his pieces surely with his beautifully manicured hand. The intervals between moves were long. Every now and then, she would see a glimmer of a possibility way down the line, 8 or 10 moves away. But she was never able to make it materialize. He had brought his rook to the 3rd rank and put it above his castled king. Its movement was limited there to 3 squares. If she could only find a way to trap it before he lifted the knight that held it back. She concentrated on it as strongly as she knew how, feeling for a moment as though the intensity of her concentration might burn the rook off the board like a laser beam. She attacked it mentally with knights, pawns, the queen, even with her king. She mentally forced him to raise a pawn so that it cut off 2 of the rook's flight squares. But she could find nothing. Feeling dizzy from the effort, she pulled her elbows off the table, put her arms in her lap, shook her head, and looked at her clock. She had less than 15 minutes. Alarmed, she looked down at her score sheet. She had to make 3 more moves before her flag fell, or she would forfeit. Lutsenko had 40 minutes left on his clock. There was nothing to do but move. She had already considered knight to knight 5 and knew it was sound, although of no particular help. She moved it. His reply was what she expected, forcing her to bring the knight back to King 4, where she had planned for it to be in the first place. She had 7 minutes left. She studied carefully and put her bishop on the diagonal that his rook sat on. He moved the rook, as she knew he would. She signaled the tournament director, wrote her next move on the score sheet, holding her other hand over it to hide it from Lutsenko, and folded the sheet to seal it. When the director came over, she said, "Adjournment," and waited for him to get the envelope. She was exhausted. There was no applause when she got up and walked wearily off the stage. It was a hot night, and she had the window open in her room while she sat at the ornate writing desk with her chessboard on it, studying the adjourned position, looking for ways to embarrass Luchenko's rook, or to use the rook's vulnerability as a cover for attacking him somewhere else. After 2 hours of it, the heat in the room had become unbearable. She decided to go down to the lobby and then take a walk around the block, if that was safe and legal. She felt dizzy from too much chess and too little food. It would be nice to have a cheeseburger. She laughed wryly at herself. A cheeseburger was what an American of a type she thought she would never be craved when traveling abroad. God, she was tired. She would take a brief walk and come back to bed. She wouldn't be playing the adjournment out until tomorrow night. There would be more time for studying it after her game with Flento. The elevator was at the far end of the hall. Because of the heat, several rooms were open, and as she approached one of them, she could hear deep male voices in some kind of discussion. When she was even with the doorway, she looked inside. It must have been part of a suite, because what she saw was a grand parlor with a crystal chandelier hanging from an elaborately molded ceiling, a pair of green overstuffed sofas, and large dark oil paintings on the far wall, where an open door led to a bedroom. There were three men in shirt sleeves standing around a table that sat between the couches. On the table was a crystal decanter and three shot glasses. In the center of the table was a chessboard. Two of the men were watching and commenting, while the third moved pieces around speculatively with his fingertips. The two men watching were Tigran Petrosian and Mikhail Tal. The one moving the pieces was Vasily Borgov. They were three of the best chess players in the world, and they were analyzing what must have been Borgov's adjourned position from his game with Duhamel. Once as a child, she had been on her way down the hall in the administration building and had stopped for a moment by the door to Mrs. Deardorff's office, which was uncharacteristically open. Looking furtively inside, she had seen Mrs. Deardorff standing there in the outer office with an older man and a woman, involved in conversation, their heads together in an intimacy she would never have expected Mrs. Deardorff to be capable of. It had been a shock to peer into this adult world. Mrs. Deardorff held her index finger out and was tapping the lapel of the man with it as she talked, eye to eye with him. Beth never saw the couple again and had no idea what they had been talking about. But she never forgot the scene. Seeing Borgov in the parlor of his suite, planning his next move with the help of Tal and Petrosian, she felt the same thing she had felt then. She felt inconsequential, a child peering into the adult world. Who was she to presume? She needed help. She hurried past the room and to the elevator, feeling awkward and terribly alone. The crowd waiting by the side door had gotten bigger. When she stepped out of the limousine in the morning, they began shouting, "Horman! Horman!" in unison, and waving and smiling. A few reached out to touch her as she went by, and she pushed past them nervously, trying to smile back. She had slept only fitfully the night before, getting up from time to time to study the position of her adjourned game with Luchenko, or to pace around the room barefoot, thinking of Borgov and the other two, neckties loosened and in shirt sleeves, studying the board as though they were Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin, with a chart of the final campaign of World War II. No matter how often she told herself she was as good as any of them, she felt with dismay that those men with their heavy black shoes knew something she did not know and never would know. She tried to concentrate on her own career, her quick rise to the top of American chess and beyond it, the way she had become a more powerful player than Benny Watts, the way she had beaten live without a moment of doubt in her moves, the way, even as a child, she had found an error in the play of the great Morphy. But all of it was meaningless and trivial beside her glimpse into the establishment of Russian chess, into the room where the men conferred in deep voices and studied the board with an assurance that seemed wholly beyond her. The one good thing was that her opponent was Flento, the weakest player in the tournament. He was already out of the running with a clear loss and two draws. Only Beth, Borgov, and Luchenko had neither lost nor drawn a game. She had a cup of tea before playing began, and it helped her a little. More important, just being in this room with the other players dispelled some of what she had been feeling during the night. Borgov was drinking tea when she came in. He ignored her, as usual, and she ignored him. But he was not as frightening with a teacup in his hand and a quietly dull look on his heavy face as he had been in her imagination the night before. When the director came to escort them to the stage, Borgov glanced at her just before he left the room and raised his eyebrows slightly as if to say, "Here we go again," and she found herself smiling faintly at him. She set down her cup and followed. She knew Flento's erratic career very well and had memorized a dozen of his games. She had decided, even before leaving Lexington, that the thing to play against him, if she had the white pieces, would be the English opening. She started it now, pushing the queen-bishop pawn to the fourth rank. It was like the Sicilian, in reverse. She felt comfortable with it. She won, but it took 4.5 hours and was far more grueling than she had expected. He put up a fight along the two main diagonals and played the four knights variation with a sophistication that was, for a while, far beyond her own. But when they got into the middle game, she saw an opportunity to trade her way out of the position and took it. She wound up doing a thing she had seldom done, nursing a pawn across the board until it arrived at the seventh rank. It would cost Flento his only remaining piece to remove it. He resigned. The applause this time was louder than ever before. It was 2:30. She had missed breakfast and was exhausted. She needed lunch and a nap. She needed to rest before the adjournment tonight. She ate a fast lunch of spinach quiche and a kind of Slavic palm frites in the restaurant. But when she went up to her room at 3:30 and got into bed, she found sleeping out of the question. There was an intermittent hammering going on above her head, as though workmen were installing a new carpet. She could hear the clumping of boots, and every now and then it sounded as if someone had dropped a bowling ball from waist level. She lay in bed for 20 minutes, but it was no good. By the time she finished supper and arrived at the playing hall, she was more tired than she ever remembered being. Her head ached, and her body was sore from being hunched over a chessboard. She wished fervently that she could have been given a shot to knock her out for the afternoon, that she could face Luchenko with a few solid hours of dreamless sleep behind her. She wished she had risked taking Olibrium. A little fuzz in her mind would be better than this. When Luchenko came into the parlor room where the adjournment was to be played, he looked calm and rested. His suit, a dark worsted this time, was impeccably pressed and fit him beautifully across the shoulders. It occurred to her that he must buy all his clothes abroad. He smiled at her with restrained politeness. She managed to nod and say, "Good evening." There were two tables set up for adjourned games. A classic rook-pawn ending was in place on one of them, waiting for Borgov and Duhamel. Her position with Luchenko had been laid out on the other. As she sat down at her end of it, Borgov and Duhamel came in together and walked to the board at the other side of the room in grim silence. There was a referee for each game, and the clocks were already set up. Beth had her 90 minutes of overtime, and Luchenko had the same, along with an extra 35 minutes left from yesterday. She had forgotten about his extra time. That put three things against her: his having the white pieces, his still unstopped attack, and his extra allotment of time. Their referee brought over the envelope, opened it, showed the score sheet to both players, and made Beth's move himself. He pressed the button that started Luchenko's clock, and without hesitation, Luchenko advanced the pawn that Beth had expected. There was a certain relief in seeing him make the move. She had been forced to consider several other replies. Now the lines from them could be dropped from her mind. Across the room, she heard Borgov cough loudly and blow his nose. She tried to put Borgov out of her mind. She would be playing him tomorrow. But it was time now to get to work on this game, to put everything she had into it. Borgov would almost certainly beat Duhamel and begin tomorrow undefeated. If she wanted to win this tournament, she had to rescue the game in front of her. Luchenko was ahead by the exchange, and that was bad. But he had that ineffective rook to contend with, and after several hours of study, she had found three ways of using it against him. If she could bring it off, she could exchange a bishop for it and even the score. She forgot about how tired she was and went to work. It was uphill and intricate, and Luchenko had that extra time. She decided on a plan developed in the middle of the night and began retreating her queenside knight, taking it on a virtual knight's tour to get it up to King 5. Clearly, he was ready for that, had analyzed it himself sometime since yesterday morning, probably with assistance. But there was something he might not have analyzed, good as he was, and that he might not see now. She pulled her bishop away from the diagonal his rook was on and hoped he wouldn't see what she was planning. It would appear that she was attacking his pawn formation, forcing him to make an unstable advance. But she wasn't concerned with his pawn position. She wanted that rook off the board badly enough to kill for it. Luchenko merely pushed up the pawn. He could have thought longer about it, should have thought longer. But he didn't. He moved the pawn. Beth felt a tiny thrill. She took the knight off the diagonal and put it not on King 5, but on Queen Bishop 5, offering it to his queen. If his queen took it, she would take the rook for her bishop. That in itself would be no good for her, paying for the rook with the knight and the bishop. But what Luchenko hadn't seen was that she would get his knight in return because of the queen move. It was sweet. It was very sweet. She looked up hesitantly at him. She had not looked at him in almost an hour, and his appearance was a surprise. He had loosened his tie, and it was twisted to one side of his collar. His hair was mussed, he was biting his thumb, and his face was shockingly drawn. He gave it a half hour and found nothing. Finally, he took the knight. She took the rook, wanting to shout with joy as it came off the board, and he took her bishop. Then she checked, he interposed, and she pushed the pawn up to the knight. She looked at him again. The game would be even now. The elegant look was gone. He had become a rumpled old man in an expensive suit. And it suddenly occurred to her that she wasn't the only one exhausted by the games of the past 6 days. Luchenko was 57. She was 19. And she had worked out with Jolene for 5 months in Lexington. From that point on, the resistance left him. There was no clear positional reason why she should be able to hurry him to a resignation after taking his knight. It was a theoretically even game. His queenside pawns were strongly placed. But now, she whittled away at the pawns, throwing subtle threats at them while attacking his remaining bishop and forcing him to protect the key pawn with his queen. When he did that, brought up his queen to hold his pawns together, she knew she had him. She focused her mind on his king giving full attention to attack. There were 25 minutes left on her clock, and Luchenko still had nearly an hour. But she gave 20 of her minutes to working it out, and then struck, bringing her king rook pawn up to the fourth rank. It was a clear announcement of her intentions, and he gave it long, hard thought before moving. She used the time his clock was ticking to work it all out, every variation on each of the moves he might make. She found an answer to anything he might do, and when he finally made his move, bringing his queen, wastefully, over to protect, she ignored the chance to grab one of his attacking pawns and advanced her king-rook pawn another square. It was a splendid move, and she knew it. Her heart exulted with it. She looked across the board at him. He seemed lost in thought, as though he had been reading philosophy and had just set down the book to contemplate a difficult proposition. His face was gray now, with tiny wrinkles reticulating the dry skin. He bit his thumb again, and she saw, shocked, that his beautiful manicure of yesterday had been chewed ragged. He glanced over at her with a brief, weary glance, a glance with great weight of experience and a whole long career of chess in it, and back one final time at her rook pawn, now on the fifth rank. Then he stood up.
"Excellent," he said in English. "A beautiful recovery."
His words were so conciliatory that she was astonished. She was unsure what to say.
"Excellent," he said again.
He reached down and picked up his king, held it thoughtfully for a moment, and set it on its side on the board. He smiled wearily.
"I resign with relief."
His naturalness and lack of rancor made her suddenly ashamed. She held out her hand to him, and he shook it warmly. "I've played games of yours ever since I was a small girl," she said. "I've always admired you." He looked at her thoughtfully for a moment.
"You are 19?
"Yes."
"I have gone over your games at this tournament."
He paused.
"You are a marvel, my dear. I may have just played the best chess player of my life."
She was unable to speak. She stared at him in disbelief. He smiled at her.
"You will get used to it," he said.
The game between Borgov and Duhamel had finished some time earlier, and both men were gone. After Luchenko left, she went over to the other board and looked at the pieces, which were still in position. The blacks were huddled around their king in a vain attempt to protect, and the white artillery was coming at its corner from all over the board. The black king lay on its side. Borgov had been playing white. Back at the lobby of the hotel, a man jumped up from one of the chairs along the wall and came smiling toward her. It was Mr. Booth.
"Congratulations," he said.
"What became of you?" she asked. He shook his head apologetically.
"Washington."
She started to say something, but let it pass. She was glad he hadn't been bothering her. He had a folded newspaper under his arm. He pulled it out and handed it to her. It was Pravda. She couldn't penetrate the bold-faced Cyrillic of the headlines, but when she flipped it over, the bottom of page one had her picture on it, playing flento. It filled three columns. She studied the caption for a moment and managed to translate it. "Surprising strength from the U.S.
"Nice, isn't it?"
Booth said. "Wait till this time tomorrow," she said. Luchenko was 57, but Borgov was 38. Borgov was also known as an amateur soccer player and once held a collegiate record for the javelin throw. He was said to exercise with weights during a tournament, using a gym that the government kept open late, especially for him. He did not smoke or drink. He had been a master since the age of 11. The alarming thing about playing over his games from Chess Informant and Shakhmatny v. USSR was that he lost so few of them. But she had the white pieces. She must hang on to that advantage for dear life. She would play the Queen's Gambit. Benny and she had discussed that for hours, months before, and finally agreed that that was the way to go if she should get white against him. She did not want to play against Borgov's Sicilian, much as she knew about the Sicilian, and the Queen's Gambit was the best way to avoid it. She could hold him off if she kept her head. The problem was that he didn't make mistakes. When she came across the stage to an auditorium more crowded than she believed possible, with every inch of the aisles filled and standees packed behind the back row of seats, and a hush fell over the enormous crowd of people, and she looked over to see Borgov, already seated, waiting for her, she realized that it wasn't only his remorseless chess that she had to contend with. She was terrified of the man. She had been terrified of him ever since she saw him at the gorilla cage in Mexico City. He was merely looking down at the untouched black pieces now, but her heart and breath stopped at the sight of him. There was no sign of weakness in that figure, motionless at the board, oblivious of her or of the thousands of other people who must be staring at him. He was like some menacing icon. He could have been painted on the wall of a cave. She walked slowly over and sat at the whites. A soft, hushed applause broke out in the auditorium. The referee pressed the button, and Beth heard her clock begin ticking. She moved pawn to queen four, looking down at the pieces. She was not ready to look at his face. Along the stage, the other three games had started. She heard the movements of players behind her settling in for the morning's work, the click of clock buttons being pushed. Then everything was silent. Watching the board, she saw only the back of his hand, its stubby fingers with their coarse black hair above the knuckles, as he moved his pawn to queen four. She played pawn to queen bishop four, offering the gambit pawn. The hand declined it, moving pawn to king four. The Alban counter gambit. He was resurrecting an old response, but she knew the Alban. She took the pawn, glanced briefly at his face, and glanced away. He placed pawn to queen five. His face had been impassive and not quite as frightening as she had feared. She played her king's knight, and he played his queen's. The dance was in progress. She felt small and lightweight. She felt like a little girl. But her mind was clear, and she knew the moves. His seventh move came as a surprise, and it was clear immediately that it was something he had saved to spring on her. She gave it 20 minutes, penetrated it as well as she could, and responded with a complete deviation from the Alban. She was glad to get out of it and into the open. They would fight it out from here with their wits. Borgov's wits, it turned out, were formidable. By the 14th move, he had equality and possibly an edge. She steeled herself, kept her eyes from his face, and played the best chess she knew, developing her pieces, defending everywhere, watching every opportunity for an opened file, a clear diagonal, a doubled pawn, a potential fork or pin, or hurdle or skewer. This time, she saw the whole board in her mind and caught every change of balance in the power that shifted over its surface. Each particle of it was neutralized by its counterparticle, but each was ready to discharge itself if allowed and break the structure open. If she let his rook out, it would tear her apart. If he allowed her queen to move to the bishop file, his king's protection would topple. She must not permit his bishop to check. He could not allow her to raise the rook pawn. For hours, she did not look at him, or the audience, or even the referee. In the whole of her mind, in the whole of her attention, she saw only those embodiments of danger, knight, bishop, rook, pawn, king, and queen. It was Borgov who spoke the word,
adjourn.
He said it in English. She looked at her clock uncomprehendingly before she realized that neither flag had fallen and that Borgov's was closer to it than hers. He had 7 minutes left. She had 15. She looked at her score sheet. The last move was number 40. Borgov wanted to adjourn the game. She looked behind her. The rest of the stage was empty. The other games were over. Then she looked at Borgov. He had not loosened his tie or taken off his coat or rumpled his hair. He did not look tired. She turned away. The moment she saw that blank, quietly hostile face, she was terrified. Booth was in the lobby. This time he was with half a dozen reporters. There was the man from the New York Times and the woman from the Daily Observer, and the Reuters man and the UPI. There were two new faces among them as they came up to her in the lobby. "I'm tired as hell," she told Booth.
"I bet you are," he said. "But I promised these people."
He introduced the new ones. The first was from Paris Match, and the second from Time. She looked at the latter and said, "Will I be on the cover?" And he replied,
"Are you going to beat him?"
And she did not know how to answer. She was frightened. Yet she was even on the board and somewhat ahead on Time. She had not made any errors. But neither had Borgov. There were two photographers, and she posed for pictures with them. And when one of them asked if he could shoot her in front of a chess set, she took them up to her room, where her board was still set up with the position from the Luchenko game. That already seemed a long time ago. She sat at the board for them, not really minding it, welcoming it, in fact, while they shot rolls of film from all over the room. It was like a party. While the photographers studied her and adjusted their cameras and switched lenses around, the reporters asked her questions. She knew she should be setting up the position of her adjourned game and concentrating on it to find a strategy for tomorrow. But she welcomed this noisy distraction. Borgov would be in that suite of his now, probably with Petrosian and Tal, and maybe with Luchenko and Liev and the rest of the Russian establishment. Their expensive coats would be off, and their sleeves rolled up, and they would be exploring her position, looking for weaknesses already there, or 10 moves down the line, probing at the arrangement of white pieces, as though it were her body, and they were surgeons ready to dissect. There was something obscene in the image of them doing it. They would go on with it far into the night, eating supper over the board on that huge table in Borgov's parlor, preparing him for the next morning. But she liked what she was doing right now. She did not want to think about the position. And she knew, too, that the position wasn't the problem. She could exhaust its possibilities in a few good hours after dinner. The problem was the way she felt about Borgov. It was good to forget that for a while. They asked about Methuen, and as always, she was restrained. But one of them pressed it a bit, and she found herself saying, "They stopped me from playing. It was a punishment." And he picked up on that immediately. It sounded Dickensian, he said.
"Why would they punish you like that?"
Beth said, "I think they were cruel on principle, at least the director was, Mrs. Helen Deerdorf. Will you print that?" She was talking to the man from Time. He shrugged.
"That's for the legal department. If you win tomorrow, they might."
"They weren't all cruel," she said. "There was a man named Ferguson, some kind of attendant. He loved us, I think." The man from UPI, who had interviewed her on her first day in Moscow, spoke up.
"Who told you to play if they didn't want you doing it?"
His name was Scheibel, she said, thinking of that wall of pictures in the basement. William Scheibel. He was the janitor. Tell us about it, the woman from the Observer said. We played chess in the basement, after he taught me how. Clearly, they loved it. The man from Paris Match shook his head, smiling.
The janitor taught you to play chess?
That's right, Beth said, with an involuntary tremor in her voice. Mr. William Scheibel. He was a damn good player. He spent a lot of time at it, and he was good. After they left, she took a warm bath, stretching out in the enormous cast-iron tub. Then she put on her jeans and began setting up the pieces. But the minute she had it on the board and began to examine it, all the tightness came back. In Paris, her position at this point had looked stronger than this, and she had lost. She turned from the desk and went to the window, opening the draperies and looking out on Moscow. The sun was still high, and the city below looked far lighter and more cheerful than Moscow was supposed to look. The distant park where the old men played chess was bright with green. But she was frightened. She did not think she had the strength to go on and beat Vasily Borgov. She did not want to think about chess. If there had been a television set in her room, she would have turned it on. If she had had a bottle of anything, she would have drunk it. She thought briefly of calling room service and stopped herself just in time. She sighed and went back to the chessboard. It had to be studied. She had to have a plan for tomorrow morning at 10. She awoke before dawn and lay in bed for a while before looking at her watch. It was 5:30, 2 hours and a half. She had slept 2 hours and a half. She closed her eyes grimly and tried to get back to sleep. But it didn't work. The position of the adjourned game forced itself back into her mind. There were her pawns, and there was her queen. There was Borgov's. She saw it. She could not stop seeing it. But it made no sense. She had stared at it for hours the night before, trying to get some kind of plan together for the rest of the game, moving the pieces around, sometimes on the real board and sometimes in her head. But it was no good. She could push the queen-bishop pawn, or bring the knight over to the king side, or put the queen on bishop 2, or on king 2, if Borgov's sealed move was knight to bishop 5. If he had moved his queen, the responses were different. If he was trying to make her analysis a waste, he might have played the king-bishop. 5:30. 4.5 hours until game time. Borgov would have his moves ready now, and a game plan arrived at by consultation. He would be sleeping like a rock. From outside the window came a sudden noise like a distant alarm, and she jumped. It was just some Russian fire drill or something, but her hand shook for a moment. She had kasha and eggs for breakfast and sat down behind the board again. It was 7:45. But even with 3 cups of tea, she somehow could not penetrate it. She tried doggedly to get her mind to open, to let her imagination work for her the way it so often worked over a chessboard. But nothing came. She could see nothing but her responses to Borgov's future threats. It was passive, and she knew it was passive. It had beaten her in Mexico City, and it could beat her again. She got up to open the draperies, and as she turned back to the board, the telephone rang. She stared at it. During her week in this room, it had not rung once. Not even Mr. Booth had called her. Now it was ringing in short bursts, very loudly. She went over and picked it up. A woman's voice said something in Russian. She couldn't make out a word of it. "This is Beth Harmon," she said. The voice said something else in Russian. There was a clicking in the receiver, and a male voice came through as clearly as if he were calling from the next room. "If he moves the knight, hit him with the king rook pawn. If he goes for the king bishop, do the same. Then open up your queen file. This is costing me a bundle."
"Benny," she said. "Benny, how can you know?"
"It's in the Times. It's afternoon here, and we've been working on it for 3 hours. Levertov's with me, and Wexler."
"Benny," she said, "it's good to hear your voice."
"You've got to get that file open. There are 4 ways, depending on what he does. Do you have it handy?"
She glanced toward the desk.
"Yes. Let's start with his knight to b5, where you push the king rook pawn. You got that?"
"Yes."
"All right. There are 3 things he might do now. B to b4 is first. If he does it, your queen pops right up to king 4. He'll expect that, but may not expect this. Pawn to queen 5.
"I don't see..."
"Look at his queen rook."
She closed her eyes and saw it.
Only one of her pawns stood between her bishop and the rook. And if he tried to block the pawn, it made a hole for her knight. But Borgov and the others could not miss that. "He's got Tal and Petrosian helping him."
Benny whistled.
"I suppose he would," he said.
"But look further. If he moves the rook before your queen comes out, where's he going to put it?"
"On the bishop file.
You play pawn to queen bishop 5, and your file is almost open."
He was right. It was beginning to look possible.
"What if he doesn't play B to B4?
"I'll put Levertov on."
Levertov's voice came over the receiver.
"He may play knight to B5. That gets very tricky. I've got it worked out to where you pull ahead by a tempo."
She had not cared for Levertov the one time she met him, but now she could have hugged him.
"Give me the moves."
He began reciting them. It was complicated, but she had no difficulty seeing the way it worked.
"That's beautiful," she said.
"I'll put Benny back on,"
Levertov said. They went on together, exploring possibilities, following out line after line for almost an hour. Benny was amazing. He had worked out everything. She began to see ways of crowding Borgov, finessing Borgov, deceiving him, tying up his pieces, forcing him to compromise and retreat. Finally, she looked at her watch and said, "Benny, it's 9:15 here."
"Okay," he said.
"Go beat him." There was a crowd outside the building. A display board had been erected above the front entrance for those who couldn't get into the auditorium. She recognized the position immediately from the car as it drove past. There, in morning sunshine, was the pawn she was going to advance, the file she was going to force open. The crowd by the side entrance was twice as big as yesterday's. They began chanting,
"Harmon! Harmon!"
before she opened the limousine door. Most of them were older people. Several reached out, smiling, fingers outspread to touch her as she hurried past. There was only one table now, on center stage. Borgov was sitting at it when she came in. The referee walked with her to her chair, and when she was seated, he opened the envelope and reached down to the board. He picked up Borgov's knight and moved it to bishop 5. It was the move she had wanted. She pushed her rook pawn 1 square forward. The next 5 moves followed a line that she and Benny had gone over on the telephone, and she got the file open. But on the 6th, Borgov brought his remaining rook to the center of the board, and as she stared at it, sitting on his queen 5, occupying a space that analysis had not foreseen, she felt her stomach sink and knew that the call from Benny had only covered over the fear. She had been lucky for it to carry her this many moves.
Borgov had started a line of play for which she had no continuation ready. She was alone again. She took her eyes from the board with an effort and looked out over the audience. She had been playing here for days, and still the mere size of it was shocking. She turned uncertainly back to the board, to the rook in the center. She had to do something about that rook. She closed her eyes. Immediately, the game was visible to her imagination with the lucidity she had possessed as a child in bed at the orphanage. She kept her eyes closed and examined the position minutely. It was as complicated as anything she had ever played out from a book, and there was no printed analysis to show what the next move was or who would win. There were no backward pawns, no other weaknesses, no clear-cut line of attack for either player. The material was even, but his rook could dominate the board like a tank on a field of cavalry. It sat on a black square, and her black bishop was gone. Her pawns could not attack it. It would take three moves to get a knight near enough. Her own rook was stuck in its home corner. She had one thing to meet it with. Her queen. But where could she safely put her queen? She was leaning her cheeks on her fists now, and her eyes remained shut. The queen sat harmlessly on the back rank, on the queen bishop square, where it had sat since the ninth move. It could only go out by the diagonal, and it had three squares. Each looked weak. She ignored the weakness and examined the squares separately, ending with king knight five. If the king was there, he could swing his rook under it and occupy the file with a tempo. That would be catastrophic. Unless she had a counter move, a check or an attack on the black queen. But no check was possible except with her bishop, and that would be a sacrifice. His queen would merely take the bishop. But after that, she could attack the queen with her knight. And where would he put it? It would have to go on one of those two dark squares. She began to see something. She could drive the queen into a king-queen fork with the knight. He would take her queen afterward, and she would still be down by that bishop. But her knight would now be poised for another fork. She would win his bishop. It would be no sacrifice. They would be equal again, and her knight could go on to threaten the rook. She opened her eyes, blinked, and moved the queen. He brought the rook under it. Without hesitation, she picked up her bishop, brought it out for the check, and waited for his queen to take it. He looked at it and did not move. For a moment, she held her breath. Had she missed something? She closed her eyes again, frightened, and looked at the position. He could move his king instead of taking the bishop. He could interpose. Suddenly, she heard his voice from across the table saying the astonishing word, "Draw." It was like a statement, and not a question. He was offering her a draw. She opened her eyes and looked at his face. Borgov never offered draws, but he was offering her one. She could accept it and the tournament would be over. They would stand up to be applauded, and she would leave the stage in a tie with the champion of the world. Something went slack inside her, and she heard her own silent voice saying, "Take it." She looked back at the board, at the real board that sat between them, and saw the endgame that was about to emerge when the dust settled. Borgov was death on endgames. He was famous for it. She had always hated them. Hated even reading Reuben Fine's book on endgames. She should accept the draw. People would call it a solid achievement. A draw, however, was not a win. And the one thing in her life that she was sure she loved was a win. She looked at Borgov's face again and saw with mild surprise that he was tired. She shook her head. No. He shrugged and took the bishop. For a brief moment, she felt like a fool. But she shook it off and attacked his queen with her knight, leaving her own en prise. He moved his queen where he had to, and she brought the knight up for the fork. He moved the king, and she lifted his heavy queen from the board. He took hers. She attacked the rook, and he moved it back by a square. That had been the whole point of the sequence beginning with the bishop, cutting down the scope of the rook by forcing it to a less threatening rank. But now it was there. She was unsure what to do next. She had to be careful. They were headed toward a rook and pawn ending. There was no room for imprecision. For a moment she felt stuck, without imagination or purpose and afraid of error. She closed her eyes again. There was an hour and a half on her clock. She had the time to do it, and do it right. She did not open her eyes, even to see the time remaining on her clock, or to look across the table at Borgov, or to see the enormous crowd who had come to this auditorium to watch her play. She let all of that go from her mind and allowed herself only the chessboard of her imagination with its intricate deadlock. It did not really matter who was playing the black pieces, or whether the material board sat in Moscow or New York, or in the basement of an orphanage. This eidetic image was her proper domain. She did not even hear the ticking of the clock. She held her mind in silence and let it move over the surface of the imagined board, combining and recombining the arrangements of pieces so the black ones could not stop the advance of the pawn she would choose. She saw now that it would be her king-knight pawn on the fourth rank. She moved it mentally to the fifth and surveyed the way the black king would advance to block it. The white knight would halt the king by threatening a key black pawn. If the white pawn stepped forward to the sixth rank, its move must be prepared for. It took a very long time to find the way, but she kept at it remorselessly. Her rook was the key, with a threatened hurdle, four moves in all, but the pawn could make the step. Now it had to move forward again. This was inch meal, but the only way to do it. For a moment, her mind became numb with weariness, and the board unclear. She heard herself sigh as she forced it back to clarity. First, the pawn must be supported by the rook pawn, and to get the rook pawn up meant a diversion by sacrificing a pawn on the other side of the board. That would give black a queen in three and cost white the rook to remove it. Then, the white pawn, safe for a moment, slipped forward to the seventh rank, and when the black king sidled up to it, the white rook pawn came up to hold it in place. And now, the final move, the advance to the eighth rank for promotion. She had come this far, these 12 moves from the position on the board that Borgov saw, by following hints and guesses and making them concrete in her mind. There was no question it could be done, but she saw no way to move the pawn that final square without having the black king snip it off just before queening, like an unbloomed flower. The pawn looked heavy and impossible to move. She could not budge it. She had got it this far, and there was no way to go further. It was hopeless. She had made the strongest mental effort of her life, and it was a waste. The pawn could not queen. She leaned wearily back in her chair with her eyes still closed and let the screen of her mind go dark for that moment. Then she brought it back for a final look. And this time, with a start, she saw it. He had used his bishop for taking her rook, and now it could not stop her knight. The knight would force the king aside. The white pawn would queen, and mate would follow in 4 moves. Mate in 19. She opened her eyes and squinted for a moment at the brightness of the stage before looking at her clock. She had 12 minutes left. Her eyes had been closed for over an hour. If she had made an error, there would be no time for a new strategy. She reached forward and moved the king knight pawn to the 5th rank. There was a stab of pain in her shoulder as she set it down. Her muscles felt rigid. Borgov advanced his king to stop the pawn. She advanced the knight, forcing him to protect. It was going the way she had seen it would go. The tightness of her body began to loosen, and over the next moves, there began to spread through her a fine sense of calm. She moved the pieces with deliberate speed, punching the clock firmly after each, and gradually, Borgov's responses began to slow. He was taking more time between moves now. She could see uncertainty in the hand that picked up the pieces. When the threatened hurdle was done with, and she inched the pawn to the 6th rank, she watched his face. His expression did not change, but he reached up and ran his fingers through his hair, ruffling it. A thrill passed through her body. When she advanced the pawn to the 7th rank, she heard a soft grunt from him, as though she had punched him in the stomach. It took him a long time to bring the king over to block it. She waited just a moment before letting her hand move out over the board. When she picked up the knight, a sense of its power in her fingertips was exquisite. She did not look at Borgov. When she set the knight down, there was complete silence. After a moment, she heard a letting out of breath from across the table and looked up. Borgov's hair was rumpled, and there was a grim smile on his face. He spoke in English.
"It's your game."
He pushed back his chair, stood up, and then reached down and picked up his king. Instead of setting it on its side, he held it across the board to her. She stared at it.
"Take it," he said.
The applause began. She took the black king in her hand and turned to face the auditorium, letting the whole massive weight of the ovation wash over her. People in the audience were standing, applauding louder and louder. She received it with her whole body, feeling her cheeks redden with it, and then go hot and wet as the thunderous sound washed away thought. And then Vasily Borgov was standing beside her, and a moment later, to her complete astonishment, he had his arms spread and then was embracing her, hugging her to him warmly. During the party at the embassy, a waiter came by with a tray of champagne. She shook her head. Everyone else was drinking and sometimes toasting her. During the 5 minutes the ambassador himself had been there, he offered her champagne and she took club soda. She ate some black bread with caviar and answered questions. There were over a dozen reporters and several Russians. Luchenko was there, looking beautiful again. But she was disappointed Borgov hadn't come. It was still mid-afternoon, and she had not had lunch. She felt weightless and tired, somehow disembodied. She had never liked parties, and even though she was the star of this one, she felt out of place. Some of the people from the embassy looked at her strangely, as though she were an oddity. They kept telling her that they weren't clever enough to play chess, or that they had played chess when they were kids. She didn't want to hear any more of that. She wanted to do something else. She wasn't sure what it was, but she wanted to be away from these people. She pushed through the crowd and thanked the woman from Texas who was acting as hostess. Then she told Mr. Booth she needed a ride back to the hotel.
I'll get a car and a driver, he said.
Before leaving, she found Luchenko again. He was standing with the other Russians, dressed impeccably and looking at ease. She held out her hand. It was an honor to play you, she said. He took the hand and bowed slightly. For a moment, she thought he might kiss it, but he did not. He pressed her hand with both of his.
All this, he said, is not like chess at all.
She smiled. That's right. The embassy was on Ulitsa Tikhovskogo, and it was a half-hour drive, some of it through dense traffic to her hotel. She had seen almost nothing of Moscow, and she would be leaving in the morning. But she did not feel like looking out the windows. They had given her the trophy and the money after the game. She had done her interviews, had received her congratulations. Now she felt at loose ends, uncertain where to go or what to do. Maybe she could sleep for a while, eat a quiet supper and go to bed early. She had beaten them. She had beaten the Russian establishment, had beaten Luchenko, Shapkin, and Live, had forced Borgov to resign. In 2 years, she could be playing Borgov for the world championship. She had to qualify first by winning the candidates' match, but she could win it. A neutral place would be chosen, and she would meet Borgov head-to-head for a 24-game match. She would be 21 then. She did not want to think about it now. She closed her eyes and dozed in the back of the limousine. When she looked out, sleepily, they were stopped at a traffic signal. Up ahead, to the right, was the forested park that was visible from her room. She shook herself awake and leaned forward to the driver. Let me off at the park. Sunlight filtered through the trees on her. The people on the benches seemed to be the same people as before. It did not matter whether they knew who she was or not. She walked past them along the path into the clearing. Nobody was looking at her. She came to the pavilion and walked up the steps. About halfway down the first row of concrete tables, an old man was sitting alone with the pieces set up in front of him. He was in his 60s and wore the usual gray cap and gray cotton shirt with the sleeves rolled up. When she stopped at his table, he looked at her inquisitively, but there was no recognition on his face. She sat behind the black pieces and said carefully in Russian, "Would you like to play chess?" This concludes the reading of The Queen's Gambit by Walter Tevis. Copyright 1983, 2014 by Walter Tevis. This book was read by Amy Landon. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Susan Schulman Literary Agency and was produced in 2018 by Blackstone Publishing, which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Publishing. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.